Hello and welcome to episode 177 of Speak Beastie for May 14th, 2023. I'm Amy.
I'm Anne.
I'm Jeff.
And I'm Marjolaine.
And we're here. We have four hosts again.
Oh,
we're so spoiled. I feel like we're going to start getting used to this.
Well, thank goodness we're recording this now, because 2 weeks from now, I'm going to be at MistyCon, and pretty much everything else this entire month has been trying to focus on that. So you caught me on the one day when I don't have to do MistyCon stuff.
Oh, thank goodness.
And I'm just back from a little vacation and another festival last week. So, yeah.
Ooh.
My first of the first con of the year, not the last.
Oh.
So fun.
How many of you are going to LeakyCon?
It is literally in my backyard, so I am.
I'm definitely going to be there one way or another.
Nice.
I think I'm the only one who's not.
No!
This is so sad. Oh, too much traveling. I couldn't do it.
I love traveling. I found it's never the traveling that I mind. Like, I keep having weird dreams about missing my flight, which just proves that I have this weird unconscious fear of not making my flight, which is impossible because I get to the airport absurdly early when I'm flying anywhere. But also, I just really like traveling. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just because I haven't had any issues with Southwest Airlines, but I like being on an airplane.
There is nothing like getting an airport McDonald's before your flight. Like, that is seriously that's one of my travel traditions. We get to Midway or O'Hare, I'll get my iced coffee and then my sausage biscuit and eat that before the flight. It is just such a vibe.
Wait, there's a McDonald's in Midway?
Not anymore.
I was about to say, every layover I've ever had has somehow brought me to Midway Airport in Chicago, and I've never seen a McDonald's there.
There used to be one in, like, that main area where there's, like, I think there's, like, a Tony Roma's and, like, some other stuff now, but I guess now they're fancy, too fancy for McDonald's, so now it's, like, an Einstein Brothers, which is still good, but I want my sausage biscuit.
It is nice to know, though, that Einstein Brothers is still a thing, because I feel like there was a time when there was an Einstein Brothers everywhere. I'm in the Louisville area, so in southern Indiana and parts of Louisville, I feel like there used to be Einstein Brothers bagels everywhere, and it's been a while since I've seen one.
Yeah, their footprint's definitely much smaller. There's one near to where I live, and it actually is, like, inextricably tied in with Beastie, because I went to get breakfast there one morning when I was listening to the episode that Jeff and Marjo did talking about, like, your live reaction to Secrets of Dumbledore.
Mm-hmm.
So my memory of Einstein Brothers is inextricably linked with listening to the two of you losing your freaking minds about the movie.
Speaking of that,
that was a good one.
I realize that it's more than a year now since the release of the movie.
Yeah.
And what we predicted last episode didn't happen. We didn't have news for the rest of the franchise. We had other news, but...
I mean, there was other news,
we'll not talk about that.
Don't look good for Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe in the future. I still hold out hope that maybe there will be a spinoff someday.
We will get to this, but the fact that there is still Fantastic Beast stuff being built elsewhere, like, we'll get to this in the Phoenix Register, is hopeful to me.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Okay, well, speaking of things that we like, this is a terrible, terrible
not
transition.
Your best.
Not my best work.
I was waiting
Sorry.
for a good segue. I'm a bit disappointing, I must say.
Wait, hang on.
Anna's just off her game today.
Speaking of themed experiences we don't want to miss...
Too much. Split the difference.
Is one themed experience you don't want to miss, because then you'll get to hang out with awesome people like this week's Patreon supporter, Patricia K, aka Shannon's mom.
Yay!
She's awesome. Shannon's awesome. Everyone's awesome. Thank you for your support.
I wish they were here, like, to hear you react to their mom like that. Because, I mean, if my mom was a Patreon supporter for an episode, I would want to be there for it.
I actually did shift things around because my mom is a Patreon supporter as well. And I shifted things around because I was like, if anyone else gives my mom a shout out, she's going to be disappointed. So next week, Shannon, next time you're on, you can give your mom a second shout out. It'll be fine.
So we started a bit to talk about the news. So I guess it's time for the Phoenix Register now.
And now a message from our sponsors. Hey you, yes you, the magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind-the-scenes features. But wait, there's more. Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wiggs knees. And how?
And we have kind of news from Epic Universe construction, I guess, because it's still pretty much not done yet. I saw the pictures. And, yeah, no, it's not done. I don't remember when it's supposed to open.
2025. Either next year or 2025.
Yeah. So, but at least we got some news through some plans that got shared. I think it's official, it's public thing, so it's not leaked things, it's public and people can see it and speculate about that. So I don't know anything about how to read a plan, so I all of what I will say, it's just more people more knowledgeable than me figure out what these plans mean. So yeah, we can have a more accurate idea of what to expect for the Wizarding Paris land. So yeah, even in the pictures we see, it looks more and more like Paris. I don't know if you saw that, but you can start to see the Haussmannian buildings of the street that will be quite high. It would be higher than anything that they did for the other Wizarding World part. It would be higher than the Diagon Alley and of course Hogsmeade. So yeah, quite immersive, I guess. And apparently we will enter in this part through the Porte Saint-Denis, which is the kind of the big, I don't know how to translate that. It's the thing that looks like the Arc de Triomphe, but it's not the Arc de Triomphe. So it's like a big door, archway. That we see in one shot in Crimes of Grindelwald. It's when we see Queenie in the street and we have the Porte Saint-Denis in the background. So yeah, they will use that. But it's a real place in Paris. And we have also more clues that leads us to think that we might have a Circus Arcanus show, because we know that one of the attractions will be a show and we will enter through a big tent. So we can, yeah, we can. It's in Paris, in Wizarding Paris, so probably Circus Arcanus. And yeah, you can access through the tent to a large theater. So yeah, that's interesting that we will have a show based on that. I hope no real snake in it. But And no animals, please. Just fancy costumes and fun animatronic, I guess. But no, please, no animals. So we see. And the other big attraction is the Ministry of Magic ride, but it's the British Ministry of Magic ride. So I still don't understand how we will, because all the rest of this part of the park will be Paris, so I don't understand how we will move from Paris to London to get to the British Ministry of Magic, but I see there is some, I don't know if it's speculation or info that we have about that, you know, about the notes.
So I was, there was an article in from Park Stop that I was reading through, and that does have like plans and stuff like that. And so I was looking through them, and it mentions, hang on, looking through the quote, the documents show how we will enter the ministry through flu network fireplaces.
Okay.
So my bet is that the outer facade for the show building is going to be the French Ministry of Magic. And then the queue will probably be in the through like that atrium area, like the glass domed atrium area that we saw. And then you flew through, like if you've done Escape from Gringotts, you know, the queue itself is in the Gringotts lobby, and then you take the elevator to the actual show building. So my guess is going to be something like that. The queue is going to be in the French ministry, then you flew from the French ministry to the British ministry, and then the pre-show and the actual rider in the British ministry, and then you probably flew back to the French ministry at the end.
I wonder who they're going to get, like, for the ride and the pre-show, because I highly doubt it'll be Eddie Redmayne. It'd be really cool if it was, but I don't think it will be. It's, like, very rarely the main character.
I read some weeks or months ago that the ride will be about a Humbridge trial, so not the same timeline of what
That's the other thing, is that they're not sticking to a specific timeline.
Interesting.
In this, so I mean, like, I don't think they're going to get Imelda Staunton, but...
See, I would think it'd be really cool to have, like, Theseus or somebody, because that makes sense going between the two ministries, if you've got, like, a ministry worker.
Yeah, but if we go back to the Potter timeline, that's a bit weird, but we see how they manage the...
I wish this was going to be in Diagon Alley. I understand that they don't have the space for it, but I really wish it was going to be in Diagon.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if they're doing that to keep everything in the parks on the same timeline. Because, like, I guess thematically it'd be kind of strange to go back several years within the same wizarding world. I don't know.
Yeah, but Circus Arcanus is pretty much a 30s, 20s thing, so...
Yeah.
Or maybe they, do a modern version of Circus Arcanus, I don't know.
I mean, that would be cool if they did it like a modern kind of freak show take on it, where it's more just like, hey, here's a guy who can hammer a nail into his nose, and less, hey, here's a lady with an unfortunate case of hirsutism.
So the rest of the park that we can guess from the plan is that we will have 5 shops. So my other guess is what kind of Parisian wizarding shop we will have. So I don't know. Maybe the French wand shop. I know it was named. We can't see them on screen, but I think it's I found the name. It's I don't know if I'm supposed to pronounce it the French way. If it's Cosme Acajor or Com Acajor, I don't know. But but yeah, I would like to see the French wand shop. Of course, the wizarding patisserie or a boulangerie where we can have croissant.
Oh my God, please, let's have a French outpost of Kowalski's bakery.
I mean, you have to have some sort of food place.
I think there's going to be it says in the article that there's going to be like a proper restaurant.
Yeah.
As well, like a full service restaurant.
One or two, I don't remember, but at least one, yeah.
Let's see here. I'm skimming through the article again.
I think it's a quick
search. There are two dining places. There's going to be a retail and dining reservate place, and then just a regular dining place.
Yeah.
See, what's interesting for me is that with the Fantastic Beasts franchise, which is not that popular by comparison to the proper the Harry Potter Wizarding World franchise, you go more international. Not as international, probably, as we originally thought we were going to or as we wish that they would have, but we go more around the world with the Fantastic Beasts franchise than we do with the Harry Potter franchise. So when you build these additions in these theme parks, you want to focus on the more popular locations. Like, you want to put Diagon Alley. To me, it would make more sense to put Diagon Alley in Paris, because Diagon Alley is the location that people know. But on the other hand, in Crimes of Grindelwald, we spend a lot of time in France, and we want to put some of those things from Fantastic Beasts into a theme park, because then the people who are actually from that area feel a bit more connected to it. It might even feel a little bit more familiar, but is that going to necessarily generate money? Because theme parks, just by and large these days, I feel like don't do the kind of business that they used to do, especially post-COVID. Like, a lot of things, including theme park experiences, have changed. So you have to put your money into the things that are going to make the most money. So do you put that with Fantastic Beasts, where you can make it a little bit more connected to the home country it's taking place in, or do you put it in the things that you know people already like because they've already spent money on it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think the recreation of Paris is in itself the attraction, I think, more, maybe even more than the Fantasy Beasts part. It's the fact that you will have the impression to be in Paris when you're in the street, because it looks really, really impressive what they are building. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about like Epcot, like the entire attraction basically is the different countries. Not so much other things. I don't know. But I guess, like, going off of what you're saying, Jeff, that's probably why they're making the ride go back to the British Ministry. Mm-hmm. Because that mm-hmm. is what's popular.
People are going to know that.
Yeah, right. But it's like they needed a different city for it to be located in, because they've already got New York and they've already got London. And, yeah, so they would need something.
Yeah, because with the Harry Potter universe in particular, you have that fascination because it's all very, very British. The original series, you see how these kind of things work, this relationship between the Wizarding World and the Muggle World in the United Kingdom. But then you start wondering, especially when you get to Goblet of Fire, what does it look like when other countries do this? And then when mm-hmm. you take things like the amusement parks to other countries, that's when you start to think, do you want to try to actually bring that to life and show people, here's our version of this? Or do you want to just say, okay, this is British Ministry of Magic, but in Japan, for example?
Mm-hmm. I wonder, too, if they're going to use the Paris location to tie into, like, Bobaton and stuff like that, that would then also be connected to the core Harry Potter franchise. Mm. So then you kind of get both.
In order to do that, you're either going to have to make up a lot of stuff, or you're going to have to go back to the creator and ask them for a ton of apocrypha in order to fill that out and make it feel authentic. And considering the state of certain things right now, I don't know if that's wise.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know about that. But the interesting thing also is that there was supposed to be another attraction that got cancel, I guess, from the first version of this land. But now you have a big part that is available for future expansion that is mm-hmm. connected to the Wizarding Paris. Mm-hmm. So, and they keep that for future extension. So that's I think on this location they have. It has to be Wizarding World related, mm-hmm. so that's interesting that they are keeping that for, future plans. I don't know if they want to do something connected to Secrets of Dumbledore. If they will wait to have another thing, maybe I don't know what they but at least they have place to do more. So that's right. Exciting.
Well, very cool.
Yeah, I'm always excited for more theme park info.
Yes.
I'm, I know we've been talking about doing our Beastie meetup when Epic Universe opens, and honestly, seeing these plans is making me more excited for that, because I have been really wanting, like, a Wizarding World live show for a while, and this article is saying that it seems like there's going to be live actors, so there's a changing area, there's a cast grill, so probably it's going to be, like, continuous shows happening, so... That is, I mean, I don't think we're going to get, like a Festival of the Lion King or, like, Mickey and the Magician or whatever in the Wizarding World, as fun as that would be, but...
Yeah. I'm also excited for, I know we talked about it a while back, but, like, the wand dueling technology that they were getting plans for.
Oh, yeah. No, they talk about that, too.
I'm very curious to see how they have worked that in and how that all works.
One of the things they talk about in the article is that in addition to the five like shops that you'll be able to go into, that every storefront is going to have a window.
Ooh,
and so there's going to be interactive elements for the wands.
Yay.
Like in Diagon Alley and Hogsmeade,
And I love doing magic.
Early rumors for this land said that there would be magical creatures within many of the windows, along rooftops, even sticking out of buildings. If true, it's possible that these could be part of the interactive wand displays as well.
Oh, ooh. Fun.
So we'll see. It's going to be awesome.
Yay.
So, speaking of beasts, another digital one this time, going back in time. It seems like the 90s or... definitely the new cool, I guess. So Bandai announced a new official Harry Potter Tamagotchi.
Oh my gosh, they're so cute.
They're so cute.
So you have two design and one of the design is definitely Fantastic Beasts because it's a little niffler. But it's just aesthetic. The two version has the same modes, but you have two different modes in it, and one of them is the Fantastic Beasts mode, where you spend 3 hours in a magical suitcase and you have to take care of your creature, and it's the same in the other is the Hogwarts mode, I think, and there you spend 3 hours in Hogwarts and you also have to take care of creature. But in the Fantastic Beasts mode, you have more creature available. You have 14, and I forgot to share the pictures, but you have a lot of them. I don't have the full list, but basically most of the beasts that you can think related to Fantastic Beasts, they are in the game. Wait, I'm looking for the detail.
My gosh, it's so cute.
Does anybody else like I had a Tamagotchi for a short while, and eventually I picked it up one day and the battery died, and it was one of the greatest feelings of relief ever, because nothing, no, hear me out, nothing gave me more anxiety as a child than the thought that one day I would pick up my Tamagotchi and it would either have run away or died. So the fact that the game lost its battery, which thankfully I understood the subtle difference between my virtual Tamagotchi has died and the battery on my Tamagotchi machine has died, I thought, well, thank goodness for this. That means I don't have to do this anymore.
So that's why now you have this 3 hours mode. So you don't... You play with the Tamagotchi for 3 hours. You need to take care of your creature for 3 hours, but after that, you restart. So you don't have this continuous burden to carry. It's just for 3 hours. So.
Traumatizing.
Watch someday. There's gonna be an article where it talks about how they had to make changes to the design of the Tamagotchi because they realized that there was an increase in the number of kids who had to go see a therapist because they never got over the fact that they accidentally killed their Tamagotchi pet. I say that jokingly, but I feel like articles about that kind of thing actually come up every now and then, so let me just say, it would not surprise me to find out that was a thing.
Or like when you had Furbies and the guilt you would feel when the Furby woke up and it was sick because you didn't play with it for like a week.
Oh, I love the Furby because you know what? The Furby would fuss at me, but the Furby wouldn't die.
Yeah, it wouldn't die, but it would like wake up and be like coughing and like don't feel good.
Which was fine. I could deal with that. What I couldn't deal with is the fact that it might run away and not love me anymore, or that it might die because I didn't take care of it.
Oh.
Like I said, subtle differences. I understand that, you know, you get sick and someone that cares about you takes care of you till you're better. And I could do that with a Furby because Furbies have batteries. And when it wouldn't let me go to sleep, my mom would just take it in the other room.
So I put the link where you can see the different beasts. So in the 14, you still have 5 different Nifers. So that's...
Oh my gosh.
All the baby Nifers. So,
oh my god! Yeah. Antonio! But you also have...
The moon calf is just adorable. You have
is
the
Danny guys. Is that supposed to be a flooper?
Yes! With the big eyes.
That's a Matigo, right? Next to the flooper?
No, I think it's a Kelpie, but...
Oh, it's a Kelpie! Yeah. I guess it is a little bit more horse-looking. Sure.
Oh my gosh, I love how the Demi guys looks like it has a cowboy mustache.
He does. He's rootin' and tootin'.
Like I wanna put a little cowboy hat on him.
So yeah, the pixel art just fits the little beasts. So yeah, and I read too that they will. It's a more evolved version of a Tamagotchi because you will have some. Characters too, so you will have Newt Scamander at some point. I don't understand how, but you will. Yeah, so yeah,
I wonder if the characters show up in the games, because there's like some mini games that you can play, it looks like.
Yeah you have mini games in it. I didn't put all the detail in it, but you have several type of mini games. So yeah, you can catch gold. It's one of the mini games. So I guess it's with the Nifers. You have post delivery if you have an owl with the Hogwarts version, I guess. Flying hippogriff and picking locks if you have Piquette, of course. so yeah, and you don't choose the which creature you have. It depends on the way you're interacting with it. It will bring you different beasts. If you are more into feeding them or petting them, I don't know. I don't know how it works, but yeah. So yeah, the bad news is for now it's only announced in Japan. So yeah, it will be released July 18 in Japan. But come on, you can release that elsewhere. It will work. So
I'm looking on. It's available like on Amazon for buying on Amazon, at least U.S. Amazon. It says it's going to be releasing in August. So maybe it's releasing in Japan in July and then worldwide later in the summer.
Oh, maybe. Yeah,
which means, hey Marjo, you could get one and have it delivered to your friend who lives in the U.S. and I can give it to you.
Cool. Interesting. So yeah, so that's the other news. And the last one is just I don't remember if we already talked about that, but the exhibition Fantastic Beasts: The Wonder of Nature is coming to Australia. So if you remember, it started in London and then in Toronto, and now it moves to Melbourne between May 18 and October 19. So Beasties from Australia, if you can go see it, because it's an amazing exhibition. So yeah,
it's a lot of Harry Potter related events that travel to Australia, and it seems like they do really, really well down there. There's the Yule Ball celebration is also going to be in Australia, and people seem really psyched about that one.
Yeah, it's cool because I think Cursed Child just stopped in Australia, so
yeah,
Australian fans now have other Harry Potter experience to replace that. And that's it for the news.
I don't know if you guys can hear it or not. It started thunderstorming pretty bad outside this morning. It's been going for about 5 hours. But thankfully, the storm is not going to put a stop to the owl post coming in.
Hooray!
Yes!
So our owl post today comes from Jerry, and Jerry says, as you work your way through the screenplay, there have been comments about why the Chillin didn't bow to Jacob or Newt or various other friends who are pure of heart. On page 18 of the Secrets of Dumbledore movie magic book, it says the Chillin bows before those with the right moral code and strength of personality to rule. The baby Chillin loves to play with Jacob and Newt and Bunty and Theseus and so on, but these people don't have the strength of personality to rule. Jacob, etc., have great moral codes, but really aren't what great rulers are made of. They even have trouble being leaders, much less rulers. Of the four people I remember the baby Chillin being happiest with, Theseus is the only one who might eventually mature into that sort of mature leadership role. I'm glad that Jerry put that at the end, because I was going to say, well, I think Theseus actually shows himself to be a born leader. It's the difference here in this comment about the difference between wanting to lead and wanting to rule. Mm-hmm. Because being a ruler or ruling over other people, to me, when you put it that way, it makes it sound like you're going to be doing a lot of telling people what to do because I said so, because I'm the one who's at the top of the heap. And it also kind of feels to be like saying that you are a ruler comes with this attitude of I get to be the ruler because either it's my destiny or I come from a better family than you. It's basically by divine right. I feel like a lot of times is kind of tied into that idea of being a ruler, whereas if you are a leader, you can be chosen by the people you are leading because they have faith in you to do it. If you're looking at it that way, then Theseus definitely, Jacob and Newt, no, because they wouldn't, to Jerry's point, I don't think they would want to be a ruler or a leader anyway, unless they could do it quietly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree about Theseus, about the difference between leader and ruler. I think Theseus can lead, but he needs order and he doesn't want to make the rule. He's better at following them, I guess. But I don't see Theseus. I mean, he's the head of the Horus. That's already the highest charge. I think he aspires to have. I don't see him be interested being minister of magic, for example.
No, probably not. Because the other thing with leadership is that there's different levels of doing it and there's different ways of approaching it. Because Theseus is a great person to be the head of the Auror office, because that's something he knows very well. And even though he's going to be in charge of people who may be different from him, they have a similar task and a similar object, and he can lead them in that way. But to be a leader, like the next step above that is head of head of the Department of Magical Law Enforcement, because the Auror office falls under that. But to be a minister of magic, to be a leader of that entire, the bigger the population, the more diverse the population, and the more different types of people who think and feel and act differently from you, you're going to have to also be responsible for their welfare. So to have a strong moral code is a good thing, but we've seen it. How many times have we seen it? People in positions of political power making decisions according to their strict moral codes that make life more difficult for other people who don't think the way that they do. Just not going to name names, just going to throw this out as an example. People who have very strong religious convictions who then get elected to office and they want their religious principles to inform the political decisions they're making, but that leads to creating laws that govern the way people who don't believe what you believe have to live. That's dangerously close to pushing your religion on people, and I think a great leader or a great ruler wouldn't do something like that.
Yeah, but yeah, it's a good point from Jerry to remind us that the chilling doesn't only look for moral and pure heart. The chilling looked for ruler, and the only born ruler in the group is Dumbledore. It's not the other one.
And that's just it. I think of all of them, Dumbledore is the one who understands the difference between what is a leader and what is a ruler, because he has proven he can be one, and he once dreamed of being the other and realized it was not for him.
Right.
Yeah. And Dumbledore says, I mean, in the canon books that takes place decades after this, Dumbledore says that it's funny, but perhaps those who are best suited to power are those who have never sought it for themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's still, being the headmaster of Hogwarts, he's still a ruler on that little word, because the ruler make rules, and as a headmaster, you make rules. You don't need to be, it's not just a leader, you also rule the school. So it's still on a smaller scale, but it's still a ruler place to fill. So it fits his personality, and is more in line with his fear to be to what you just said, the fear to not be the right person if you have more power. So,
And they make this very, very unclear in the original series exactly how much of what goes on at Hogwarts is because Dumbledore decides things and how much is the Board of Governors. They don't tell you what the Board of Governors actually do. The one instance the only times we ever really hear them mentioned even is when Lucius Malfoy bullies them into suspending Dumbledore, and when the Board of Governors may be talking about closing the school for everybody's safety. They don't really do a good job of distinguishing how much actual authority and how much power the headmaster has at Hogwarts, and how much of what he does he has to run it by the Board of Governors. Not that Dumbledore would really be that fussed about it. He would probably just do what he thought was best and deal with the fallout rather than ask permission. But still, if you're talking about the difference between the way things actually happen and the way they're supposed to happen on paper, they don't really explain that very well.
Yeah,
but that's the same thing in a ministry or in a government, between the, I don't know, the president and the people who are supposed to validate or not the decision. So, yeah, the balance of power, that's always on different scale. It's always the question, and even when you have rules, it doesn't always work. And I talk about that as a French who is dealing with that right now. Anyway.
Just remember, you can't measure leaders with rulers. You have to use a measuring cup.
Oh my god.
Hey, I have to have dad jokes now, you guys.
It's true. Oh no, we have now there's gonna be 18 years of this.
Oh.
No. Oh, I'm not going to stop at 18 years.
You've already been practicing.
Yes, I have been practicing dad jokes for years. Now I have a reason.
Well, thank you, Jerry, for your wonderful owl post. And if you have your own thoughts about leaders versus rulers or anything else we talk about, speakbc@gmail.com. We'd love to see what you got to say. We are moving into our main discussion, which, special treat this week, y'all. The scenes are more than one sentence.
Hooray.
Hooray.
Yeah, some are pre-sentence.
Three whole sentences. There is even lines. We have dialogue this week. We had literally zero dialogue last time. Well, we are starting with scene 83 of the screenplay. Exterior, alleys / stone steps, Bhutan, same time, day. We have Newt rounding a corner, sees two aurors. He spots someone else. Jacob says, "Hey, fellas." Jacob hits them with his case.
Because that's the one spell he knows. Axio, my fist.
And I gotta say, like, Jacob is the number one bro, sees his friend is in trouble, hits a cop in the face with a suitcase. May we all have and be such a friend.
It's impressive that he catches both of them in one swing.
Yeah. And it's not the first time that he's done that move either. Yes. Like the first movie that begins with Jacob hitting his new best friend in the face with a suitcase. This is Jacob's go-to move.
It's like his Expelliarmus.
Yeah, it fits the circle theory. It fits the circle theory exactly. In the two mirror scene of Jacob hitting Newt and then Jacob saving Newt by hitting others with the suitcase.
Now, when he does it here, it almost, not quite, but almost for me, makes up for the missed opportunity they had where Queenie could have opened up the case to show Mr. Abernathy her ladies' things and he could have popped out and punched him in the face.
That would have been cool.
And they could have used the incredible line, "This case packs a real punch, sweetie." I'm still mad they didn't think of that.
So, Mario, can you talk more about the onomatopoeia?
Yeah.
Yeah, because here. In the screenplay, they use a very weird one. I mean, for me, at least, it's... how do you pronounce that?
Thwack.
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 T-W-H-A-C-K.
That's not how I would have spelled it.
Is it the H then the W?
Yeah.
I mean, either way, it is a weird word.
Yeah.
And yet somehow you know what it is. That's the thing about onomatopoeia. That's part of what makes them onomatopoeias, I feel like.
I don't. When I read that, I have no idea what it is.
I mean, thwack to me sounds like smack, but you've got the sound in front of it, which is kind of like the whooshing sound of him bringing the suitcase around. So thwack.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, it's like more like the th gives it kind of more of a thud. Mm-hmm. So it's like more of a solid, like it's a whack, but with more weight behind it.
I would have said like thunk.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I would say, Marjo, you talk about what you would use in French, and this is fascinating. Yeah. Like, tell me more.
I would say puff. Or bim, but more puff, I think.
Huh.
P-A-F.
So when you say paff, like, what does that imply to you? Like, if I say, like, hit with a paff, what does that mean to you?
It's a hit. Usually, it's a paff. It's when what it's used in comics when you have somebody hitting something or someone. So, or two things crashing, it's paff. Oh. It's a big paff. So bim is more something that is falling. I don't know. It's paff is more like two people fighting with fist is paff. But
okay,
interesting,
amazing. I love that.
I wonder if when they were creating all of these iconic comic book characters like Spider-Man and Batman, when they would use these onomatopoeias that could potentially take up an entire page or at least an entire like block in a page of a comic book, I wonder if they ever had to think this hard. Like, no, this onomatopoeia doesn't feel quite right. It doesn't feel like a bamf. It feels more like a puh. What do you guys think?
No, I think so, because they're very specific about the onomatopoeia they use in comics.
Yeah.
Because bam doesn't always work. Sometimes it has to have more subtlety.
Yes. Sometimes it has to be paff. Which is my new favorite onomatopoeia. I need to figure out how to use that.
I feel like that should be the title of this episode. Sometimes it just has to be paff.
Oh, I love it when we come up with titles. It makes it so much easier on me. Thank you.
That's funny. Now, on the one hand, I personally don't tire of seeing Jacob just occasionally haul off and whoop somebody, because sometimes, first of all, it is deserved. And also because I do feel for Jacob, the fact that he's surrounded by these wizards all the time and he can't do magic. So occasionally when he does stuff like that, it reminds you, hey, Jacob is useful. But it also feels a little bit like they're saying, oh, look at this primitive form of combat that the nomad is using because he can't do anything from a distance. He's a close up, punchy in the face kind of bro.
How very New Yorker of him.
I don't know. To me, it doesn't necessarily feel like a judgment, like, oh, it's so primitive. Sometimes it's saying, like, you can have all the fancy magic you want, but if somebody's got just a pair of fists or a gun, all the magic in the world can't save you. Bye. Yeah.
That's true.
All right. So moving on to scene 84. Exterior. Narrow alley leading upward, same time, day. Jacob stumbles around a corner and races up some steep, narrow steps. Moments later, his pursuers come into view, stop, and stare upward. Empty, except for Jacob's case.
I love when he's running in this scene and he's looking behind him. Dan does these great little ad-libs.
Yeah.
There's one where he just looks behind him at the oar, and you see the oar coming around the corner, and he just goes, oh, he's angry. He's running.
See, this is why Dan, I feel I'm so glad that his career has really taken off, and I feel like he's like really starting to get recognized as a legitimate serious actor, because even though he's this very funny guy, he's also very, very intelligent, because he's one of those guys that you can trust him to improvise. Not everybody is great at it, but you can put him in a scene, and if you want him to just do the lines, he'll do the lines at least once. But you gotta let him just play in the sandbox a little bit, because he's gonna give you some really great stuff that you might not have thought of.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's like Tim Conway that way. You guys know Tim Conway, right?
Yeah. Yes.
That was something he was famous for. He was famous for doing that, because they'd record episodes of the Carol Burnett Show twice, and he would do the first take exactly as written to the letter, and then the second take he would always end up just making up whatever he thought was going to work, and 9 times out of 10 they would end up using the take where he was just making stuff up.
Nice. So, how do you all think that Jacob vanished so quickly? Because is he like just around the corner? Does he have some kind of disillusionment charm, or did he actually aberrate? Because surprise, it's actually magic, and the snake ward wand actually works.
I think he's just around the corner, and it might just be a little bit of an editing whoopsie, like, we didn't really think about either they're just going to take for granted that enough time passed in this brief second or two, or we should have probably like spaced that out by another second or two. But like, I'm a runner. And most of the time when I go out running, I'm focusing on distance rather than speed, so it might not seem like I can run all that fast. But if I'm doing a timed event, or if I'm only have so long to go out and run and I'm actually trying, then a lot of times when your adrenaline kicks in and you aren't thinking about how much time has passed, but you are thinking, okay, I need to push myself as fast as I need to go, you can actually end up moving a lot faster than you think you can a lot of the time.
Makes sense.
Yeah, or it's like maybe just Jacob is just hiding in a corner very close, you know, in movies when you but we are missing the shot where we see Jacob hiding. Yeah. But you know, in the movies when a character see and you expect to see the other one and it's just hiding in the ceiling or in the corner and you don't know, you didn't saw the character moving from the middle of the hallway to the corner or mm-hmm. to the ceiling, but it's just we don't see Jacob just under the curtain in the corner.
So, Amy, you've rewatched, like, was it just a smash cut and then Jacob's gone? Or did we actually see how he disappeared?
We don't see it, no.
Okay.
Yeah. They just kind of, like, get there. Like, you see Jacob running, you see the oars running, and then you see the end of whatever it is, the alleyway or whatever, and he's not there. But the case is there.
Okay. All right, well, then moving on to scene 85. Exterior, back streets, Bhutan, same time, day. So we're back to Helmut and the boys with Lally and Theseus's cases.
Did they make up the term dark auror when they put out this? Yes. I know I keep making this big thing about the difference between the script the actors used in the published version based on the movie that we've already seen. But I get a little bit of a twinge of ugh when I see the words dark auror, because I get it. They are technically aurors and they work for the bad guy. But dark auror is an oxymoron, and oxymorons drive me nuts.
No, they definitely, this is the first time we're seeing dark aurors, and I guess it's to differentiate them from Theseus, the light auror, or whatever.
Or Tina, yeah.
Which is stupid, but anyway.
I feel like we don't need that much help distinguishing, but there's like two not dark aurors in the whole thing, but okay. And one of them is not here right now.
So they set the cases down. One of the aurors takes aim. And Helmut says, wait, open them, make sure it's in there, idiot. Which, first of all, yikes, harsh. Secondly, it's interesting that they are immediately moving to disarm it, and Helmut is telling them to make sure it's in there. So I was thinking, like, so we the viewers immediately assume that the aurors must know that the Chelan is in there. Mm-hmm. But as far as the actual dialogue scenes, I don't think, at least not as far as I've reread, they say anything about the Teelan. So as far as they know, they could just be anything that is a singular dangerous object in the case. And I guess they have to open the case to make sure it's in there rather than just destroying the case. Mm-hmm. So I'm presuming that they don't think it's a bomb or something else that's easily triggered, or else they're not dark aurors. They're just dumb aurors.
I assumed that they knew about the Chelan just because, you know, I feel like they would know something about what the plan is and what's going on. And they also know that it would be some sort of creature, because by this point, Newt has that bit of celebrity from his book coming out. So I feel like they would know his suitcase has creatures in it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they did know about the Chelan, but I think telling them about the Chelan was honestly unnecessary. I also think the fact that they're trying to open these cases to see what was in them was not the right... That was not the vibe. That's not what they should have been given to do. What they should have been told is neutralize the enemy, obtain the target, bring it back to home base, and let the leader sort it out. Which, by the way, how funny would that be? Like, I love all these different everything, everywhere, all at once moments when the cases open up and you see the catastrophes happening to all these different groups of bad guys. But can you imagine if they were all gathered in the one room and they just opened the cases and then it's pastries, bam, books, bam, Quidditch, bam, just all in one room. Exactly.
Paff, paff, paff,
paff, paff, paff.
So in addition to this dialogue, Helmut calls this guy an idiot. And then the other guy who's trapped in the wall is banging one of his fists to be let out because he's trapped in a wall. It's going to be like pretty traumatizing. And Helmut sighs before letting him out.
He looks so exasperated.
And, like, maybe they're dark aurors because nobody respects them on the job, Helmut. Maybe they wouldn't be dark aurors if you were nice to them.
Oh. Isn't that a thing? Like, isn't there some movie where, like, you have a bunch of hench people and eventually the hench people get tired of being mistreated by their leader and they're like, hey, you should get to know us. We're all really nice people. We don't want to be hench people anymore. I swear that bit has been done in something before, but I can't for the life of me think of it.
Probably.
That wasn't a Shrek thing,
really,
was it?
They focus on the hench people in the Venture Brothers, but I don't know if that's what you're thinking of.
You know what? It very well could be the Venture Brothers, and you'd think I would have seen that because I've definitely met one of the voice actors from Venture Brothers, but I have not seen the show.
It's really good.
Yeah. I think Helmut is... I don't know. We don't know anything about him, but he looks so bored and so sad. I don't think he likes his job.
Well, no, because I mean, wouldn't it feel a little No, he looks like such a hench person. Like, he's got enough skill to be on this team. He's dedicated enough to the leader of their group to be trusted, but he makes boneheaded bad guy mistakes because this is one of those situations where the bad guys have to be almost this cartoonish version of a bad guy. It's like, yes, we are the bad guys, and yeah, we're kind of taking over, but at some point we're going to make boneheaded bad guy mistakes and we're going to end up going, whoops, guess we're in jail now.
Yeah, but
or dead.
We can have bad guy who enjoy themselves. I mean, we have Vinda Rosier who clearly enjoy herself, but Helmut is clearly not happy.
I really just think Vinda is just an agent of chaos. She's not like
she is.
She's not here because she wants to fight for, you know, pure blood wizard supremacy or because she thinks Grindelwald is so hot or whatever. She just wants to set stuff on fire.
Yeah, no, Vinda Rosier is here to be hot and set things on fire. And that's it. If you get in her way, you're getting on fire.
Banners better beware.
Yep. So Lally and Theseus, quote, glance at the cases. And they, like, it really, like, they don't know if they have the killer or not.
Nope.
Yeah.
So what would the Aurors have done if they had opened these cases and the Kidan had been in one of them? So presuming they haven't been told what's actually the case, and they have been told it's something extremely dangerous, they open the case and they find just a little guy? What do you do when you open the case? You're like, oh my god, it's a baby giraffe! So cute! And what did Theseus and Lally do?
Yeah. You know what would happen is they'd all be like, aw, and then the chillin' would start running really fast and they'd be like, crap, somebody catch it! And then instead of using a summoning charm because they're bad guys who think with their bad guy brains, they just start chasing it on foot.
Yeah. And tripping over each other, crashing into things.
Oh, and then the chillin' is just like, outsmarts them and like darts around a corner and the aura's all dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum down the stairs.
He's running around his little chillin' feet.
It's so cute. Howdy, howdy, howdy. If you catch me, I'll give you me pot of gold.
No, he wouldn't say that.
What? All right, so last scene 86. Exterior, backstreets, Bhutan, same time, day. And in the screenplay, there is a rendering of the Dark Aurors being attacked by pages and a bludger.
Okay, I thought for a second that this was two different pictures. Because, like, on the left, you've this almost serious black-looking guy who's hanging on to what looks like a dock next to a, you know, angry sea surrounded by Batman bats or whatever it is behind him. And then on the other side, I swear for a second, I thought I was looking at the book cover for The Vile Village from A Series of Unfortunate Events, where they're all holding on to a rope ladder connected to a hot air balloon. But it's not. This is just the one image of them being attacked by books.
Yep. Yeah, I can see where the confusion is because there's, like, the serious black-looking guy, as Jeff described him, is being attacked by the bludger, and he's in front of a wall. Mm-hmm. And then there's the end delineation, the end of the wall, and it does look like it's a separate, it's completely cut off, because the pages from the other case are, like, moving in front of it, but there's none, like, clearly in front of that one side of the wall and the other side of the wall. So it's definitely visually confusing.
Yeah.
So Jacob, pursuers, tentatively approaches the abandoned case. One of Helmut's boys kneels beside the other case, or two of Helmut's boys kneel beside the cases. Pop! Jacob's case flips open to reveal Polish pastries, and Lally's and Theseus' cases are open, revealing books and the golden snitch.
So, that's a change in this scene, because in the million scenes that we covered in the last two or three episodes, they change scene every time we change places, in quote. I mean, when we are in Jacob, it's one scene. When we cut to Lally and Theseus, it's another scene. And in this one, it's all in one scene. So, why? I mean, like you said in the document, I don't complain because of course, it's not fun for us to focus on a scene with one sentence. Mm-hmm. But it's consistency, please. Be consistent in your screenplay. So I don't know if we... So no, I think I remember that we discussed that some time ago. But do you think what came out of the cases adapt to who was holding it? Because, of course, we have books in Lally's case. We have the pastries in Jacob's case. And so it seems like... nice coincidence that it worked that way. But in Theseus, it's Golden Snitch and Bludgers. So is it an indirect information that he played Quidditch? Or maybe he's a Quidditch fan? I don't know.
Like, to me, it has to be that. Like, there's no way that Dumbledore filled a case with Polish pastries and then Newt ends up with that one. You know? Like, no. I'm thinking maybe I'm not sure how it would work, but I feel like, yeah, it has to adapt to whoever's carrying it.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Either it adapted to whoever picked it up and filled itself with something that made sense to them, or they were like unconsciously drawn to a case that was supposed to be for them. But yeah, either way, I don't think it's a coincidence. And I can't remember, but I feel like we did know that Theseus played Quidditch, but I can't remember how we knew that or where we got that info.
I don't think there is any clues in, at least on screen or in the...
Yeah. I don't think they actually say it. I think that might be one of those movie magic book things that we found out about when those got published, because the closest we really get to anybody talking about playing Quidditch when we are in the movies is when Newt offhandedly says, oh, I'm more of a chaser, really.
Mm-hmm. Great line.
Okay, great, so the Harry Potter line. Wiki just says that while at Hogwarts, he was implied to have been a popular and academically gifted student to the point of having been referred to as a schoolboy hero. So,
I mean, it makes sense that he would have been on the Quidditch team because, they idolize everyone on the Quidditch teams. You know, Mr.
Yeah.
Popular.
It fits in with this classic image so well. He's top of his class. He's probably a prefect. Everybody really likes him. So as long as he already fits the popular jock stereotype, why not just bring it on home and say, yeah, he was a great big Quidditch hero. His house won the league all the time. On the other hand, though, even if that wasn't the case, even if he didn't play Quidditch, this Quidditch trap that's in this case was still a good idea, so they probably still would have used it, and it wouldn't really have mattered who was carrying the Quidditch case, because having a personal connection to the trap in the case, I don't feel like that's necessary. That's just Dumbledore being cheeky. Because this is a very serious, very scary, very dangerous thing that they're doing. And the moment of true action here where all these traps are going off, you know, a lot of times you've probably been through a lot of nerve-wracking tension and anxiety. So this is that very Dumbledore-ish brief moment of comedy. Yes, you are still on task. You're still doing the job. The diversion is still going off the way it's supposed to. But it's also, he knows me. It's fun. Like, I personally, for Jacob and his case full of pastries, I like this idea that I've got in my head where at some point before they left, Dumbledore took Jacob aside and said, son, we are going to need pastries. Lots and lots of pastries. Why don't I show you where the kitchens are? And then he sees this giant kitchen. He just straps on an apron and says, let's get started.
That actually, I was thinking, like, either that happens or Dumbledore goes to, like, the Polish bakery in Berlin and just sets the case on the counter and says, fill her up! Like, but he says it in Polish, so he says, napelny.
He just walks in, looks at behind him at all of the, like, all the donuts arranged according to color, according to size, according to type, and he just says, I'll take it. You'll take what? All of it.
He says, talk.
Like, I'll take the store. And then they look at the case and say, do you think it'll fit? And he just taps it and says, I wouldn't worry about that.
Well, we know for a fact that he's got punchkis in there, which is a kind of donut.
Punchkis are good, by the way. Well. If anybody out there has not had it, yesterday we ended up having a discussion on a different podcast about whether or not anybody had ever had Knickerbocker Glory, and now you've mentioned punchkis. Punchkis are good. Like, everybody, you should try one.
Yes, like, every year in Chicago for Fat Tuesday, it's punchki day. So you just order a bunch of punchkis and eat them.
And don't they sometimes have like little charms or little extra somethings hidden in them?
Not in Chicago. I think that's more of a king cake thing.
Okay. That's right. I was thinking of king cake, sorry.
Because punchkis already have like fruit or cheese or chocolate filling. So I feel like if you also put like a plastic baby in there, you're going to end up with somebody choking on it. So. So speaking of the pastries, however they're pronounced, do y'all think they have a Geminio charm on them? Or is it just a previously unseen explode and multiply charm?
I think it... See, that's the tricky thing. I was thinking that it was a Geminio charm. But when we like think about when Hermione does it to the locket in Deathly Hallows, she just puts the charm on the thing and makes two of it. When they're trapped in the vault at Gringotts, Griphook mentions that they've added Geminio and Flagrante curses so that it will multiply and burn as you touch it. So I think it can be used in different ways. And I would buy that it's a Geminio charm, but if it is, then it's not been set up to where you have to touch it. It's just going to multiply and expand no matter what. And originally I was thinking that they did do it on purpose as kind of like a throwback to Deathly Hallows when they were in the vault, but it's a weird kind of throwback because chronologically the events of Deathly Hallows take place several decades after this, but it was an idea that was presented in a book that was published several years before this movie got made. So it's kind of a grandfathered in throwback, if that's what they were going for.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. It may not necessarily be a Geminio charm. We would have to probably look at exactly. Like, again, this is guesswork about what magical theory looks like, because we don't know how that charm necessarily works. We know that you can use charms in different ways.
Yeah, no, I think it's Dumbledore's magic, so it's probably in combination of different spells, and yeah, I think it's a creation for the purpose of this trap. But I think visually it's definitely a throwback to what we saw in the Potter movies. And that's not the only one, because that's the in this scene, because that's what I don't like in this scene actually, is the music. Because it's the exact quote from a theme from the Potter movies, and I don't like that because it doesn't make sense in this scene to have this specific theme, I guess. So I don't mind having Hedwig theme because it's connected to magic and it was used very discreetly in very specific scenes, but there it's too, I don't know. The first time I was, did they forget to have a music for this scene and they took just a random one from the Potter movies? Because it doesn't make sense to have this music there. But yeah, it still bothers me, but that's maybe just me.
I love the idea of like they're in the editing room, the movie's coming out next week, and they're like, oh god, you guys, we forgot to add music to the scene. Quick, grab something from the Chamber of Secrets soundtrack.
Like, can somebody text actually, James, and James texts them back and was like, new phone, who dis? And they said, ah, screw it, we'll just use one of the old themes. Who's going to notice?
Actually, that's actually what I thought, because when I saw it, it was on preview, so it was maybe, it was several weeks before the premiere, and I was, is it, it's not done? They forgot something.
That's just a stand-in, Shirley.
It is, and don't call That's me funny. Shirley. You can call me Shirley, it's fine.
Hey, just keep coming, folks. And so along the lines of the pastries with the Geminio charm, are the books charmed to explode within a certain amount of time unless there's a counter spell or something else is used to stop it? And so if Lally had needed to open the case, would that have happened to her? Because presumably Dumbledore's not going to give her the counter spell because she's not supposed to know what's in her book and if or in the book in the case. And if he says, oh, BT Dubs, if you open the case, the counter spell is whatever. She's like, why am I getting a counter spell with the baby shield? Is it going to explode too? So I don't know. I have a lot of questions.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the books of monster already exist in this time, so that's a new canon fact. Because I don't know why I thought it would be a more recent thing, or maybe it was something that was lost in the publishing world because nobody wanted this book before Hagrid asked it for his course, so I don't know. But
I mean, you'd think that if it had been around since the 30s, the way to placate it would be fairly common knowledge.
Yeah, but nobody wanted this book before Hagrid.
Yeah, fair.
But yeah, I think it was too much Potter throwback in this scene for me. The Monster Book of Monster, the music, the Quidditch balls,
the charm, yeah. The on charms, the pastries.
Yeah.
I just love the chaos.
Yeah, I love the chaos.
They could have changed the music, but I like the chaos of just everything.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Helmut furiously strips a piece of paper from his face, only to discover in the chaos Lally and Theseus have escaped because Lally and Theseus knows that when a cop gets mad, you don't want to be there. So they bounce. That wraps up our main discussion.
Hooray.
Woo. Okay. So now we are going to head into Nomadge Movie Magic.
Ladies and gentlemen, please find your seats. Nomadge Movie Magic is about to begin.
For this episode, I wanted to focus a little bit on visual effects. And of course, we know Christian Manns was sort of heading that up for Secrets of Dumbledore. The movie was shortlisted for an Oscar in the visual effects category, did not get the nomination, which I'm still a little sad about.
Single tear.
So when watching these scenes for the main discussion, I was thinking about how the visual effects, they really used a lot of props and more tangible items in the fight scenes in this film, not just in this part, but in other parts of the film as well. Thinking about like the candidate's dinner and the paper and all that stuff. You know, the books attacking people, pastries multiplying, bludgers flying around. So, funnily enough, when I came across an interview with Christian Manns about the visual effects for the movie, he actually said that was intentional in the aim. And the quote, he says, "David wanted me to make everything look more practical and tangible." And he said something about there shouldn't be any sparkles. It should be very, like, you know, down to earth and just more like objects and not look super magical, and that's kind of the magic of it.
I'm imagining the people on set saying, okay, so it will be tangible, so we will throw pastries.
So it will really look tangible. You can eat it.
Or like, okay, in this scene, you guys are going to be running away from a giant mountain of pastries that just gets bigger and bigger. So we're going to take all these boxes of Dunkin' Donuts and we're going to put ceiling fans next to them and just kind of waft the smell towards you, really get you in that zone.
And then we might throw some at you just to really immerse you.
Just to make it really realistic.
But don't catch it in your mouth. You're going to be tempted to catch it in your mouth. Please don't.
So lot of really good information that I found was in this interview that Christian Manns did with artofvfx.com. And this came out in the spring of 2022. So shortly after the movie came out. But he also, in this article, talks a bit about creating the Chilin and how they were worried if they included a mane on it, like it's described in some legends, that it would look a little too close to the Zawu. So that's why they made it more of like this reptilian deer thing without a mane. Hmm. But a really interesting part of the interview that I found was when he describes how they created like the digital elements of sets. So obviously, you know, like we talked about earlier, these movies are so global, and this one especially goes to so many different places. That's a lot of sets that they had to create, and you know, you can't build the entire thing physically. So there are parts that you have to fill in afterwards with visual effects. So how they did this was location scouts actually went out to find the locations. They did a lot of this in 2019, he said, so before the pandemic. And then when the pandemic hit, he had said it made it a little bit more difficult because they couldn't revisit places. They had to kind of work with different companies that were based in those places to get more imagery to help them build these sets. So Stuart Craig would build the sets. And because there's always that end point on a physical set, like, you know, the end of the street or the horizon or whatever it is, the visual effects team would then have to extend it digitally so that it just naturally fades out and we don't see that ending and that cutoff of the set. So they would go out to the locations that were chosen to inspire the sets, and they would scan with LiDAR, which is basically just a 3D scan of an environment or a landscape. And they would also gather images of landscapes and of buildings that fit the time period. So like the Bhutanese village, they would have images of buildings that would make sense there that they could then recreate. And they also did this in Berlin. Hmm. So then I have this really long quote, but I thought it was interesting to include. So he says, quote, "In Berlin, for example, Clear Angle Studios captured around 100 period buildings. Once processed, we were able to give these to Mark O'Kane, our in-house modeling artist, who cleaned up the geometry and combined them with a model of the proposed set he had built from the art department plans and elevations. He worked closely with art director Alex Bailey to create layouts for each of the street extensions for the multiple sequences. These were fed to Priebus for the Credence Dumbledore duel, for instance, making sure what we were showing to David Yates, was as close as possible to what he would see eventually." Hmm. So he talked a lot about how important it was to have a lot of this done before they started filming, so that they could actually visualize what those sets would look like once fully complete with the visual effects in place.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me, because like I've said that when we were in Berlin, especially when we were in the Unter den Linden area, there were times when I would be looking around like, I've been here before. And I realize it's because of like some of the sequences in the Dumbledore-Credence duel. Mm-hmm. That is spot on to what you would actually still see in Berlin in 2023. And so the fact that they were modeling buildings that would have been around at that time that are still extant in Berlin,
yeah,
makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. He also talked about how they had to really use technology to get things done during the COVID shutdowns and restrictions. Because, I mean, I feel like we knew this when it was happening because we had like no news of filming and it was a big thing. But I feel like we forget about it now that this movie was made during COVID. So They had to really adjust to that. And he mentioned this iPad software that they used that they could drop themselves into like a street view version of the set. And that way everyone could see what it looked like while they were all remote. They could just have those meetings and be like in the set so everyone could see it. And then once they got to filming afterwards, they would add in the effects. But like everyone already knew what it was going to look like and got that street view version that you would get if you were standing on the set approving it before the movie filming happened.
That's really cool.
Yeah, because I knew that it was it's now more common that they work that way, but usually when you think of VFX, you think of After Effects, things that come after shooting, but now so much is done before even the main shoot, so that's really interesting. Yeah.
Right. It helps because the actors then kind of know what it's going to look like too, so they can figure out what they're supposed to be looking at. The director's already got the full vision, so they know what, you know, what angles they need or what they need to do on set to make it work. But there's a lot of really interesting stuff in this interview, so if you're interested in reading more, it's very, very long, but there's a lot in there, and it's on artofvfx.com. So we'll try and link that in the show notes as well, but it's very, very interesting. Lots of cool stuff in there.
Cool.
Very cool. Thank you, Amy.
So for our podcast question this episode, the only trap that we didn't see is the trap in Newt's decoy case. So we want to know, what do you think would be this trap in Newt's case? So yeah, we'd love to hear your ideas. So you can drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets, or you can also email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And don't forget also to leave us a review on Apple Podcast.
While you are out and about on the internet, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SpeakBeastie, on Facebook.com/SpeakBeastie. We just released some of our Patreon exclusive wallpapers that Liz and our social media team made. So if you're interested, yeah, I know you've heard me plugging those for months. So if you aren't part of the Patreon yet, you can check those out on Facebook and then hop over to join our Patreon. To see the rest. Well, while you're doing that, you can do that by going to patreon.com/speakbeastie. We have cool stickers. We have other cool things. Just this month, on May the 4th, we had a very special crossover that was extremely expertly photoshopped and looked really, really good. That's all I'm saying. So if you're interested, you better go check it out. And we've got all sorts of cool stuff coming up. So if you want to join the fun, patreon.com/speakbeastie. So that wraps it up. I'm Anne.
I'm Amy.
I'm Marjolaine.
And I'm Jeff. Case closed.